forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. My guest is Tobias Schulze. He's a director of Talking Cure. He's a clinical psychologist. We're going to talk about some of the disorders he sees, such as narcissism or a personality disorder, and his work as a clinical psychologist. So welcome, Tobias.
Welcome. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, tell me a bit about your background and how you got into this area of psychology.
Yeah, that's a good question. I studied psychology, and funnily enough, when I initiated that journey, I didn't want it to become a clinical psychologist. That was the furthest from my mind. I had all the usual preconceptions. You don't want to work with mental ill people. That's very draining, difficult work. And it was only after I finished my master's that a good friend of mine, he was doing the clinical training and I was doing a PhD. And the more I listened to him talking about his clinical work, I discovered that's really what I want to do. And so I switched my postgrad and started a postgrad training in clinical psychology and psychotherapy. And that's how I got into the work that I'm doing now. I had to unlearn much of misconceptions.
Mm. Oh, what did you have to unlearn? Like in the clinic, were things very different from what you learned at school, or what was the change?
The misconceptions were right, that the work is draining, that these people are all crazy and somehow just a very negative energy. And the truth is far from it. I take a lot of joy from my work and the passion that people also bring in their suffering. There's a lot of passion expressed in their suffering that sometimes gets stuck, that sometimes doesn't know where to go. And so much of the work is really working on some of these very vital themes for clients. And that, and if it goes well, is so rewarding for all involved, for the client and for the therapist, to see that somebody can really tap into their potential, tap into their vital longings and dreams.
What's an example, you know, without naming names, of course, but, you know, of a client's story that really impacted you and you were able to help them and they were much happier after that?
Well, I remember, so here in New Zealand, I worked at the DHB, and I remember one woman that came to me in her mid-early 40s, and she's struggling with depression and had struggled for much of her life, had a very difficult upbringing, quite a lot of strife in her parental home, and she came with this very depressed experience. And as we kind of started understanding that more and more, it became clear that much of that depression stemmed from a sense of that her sense of self-expression, her sense of her own desire, her own initiative, those were all stunted by her mother. She was a very critical woman. And so she really felt much of her life that she wasn't allowed to express herself in that way. And for example, she had a therapy prior to seeing me where, you know, and she was very submissive, you know, in that therapy, trying to do exactly what the therapist wanted. And it never got really caught that that is part of her traumatic response in a way. And so the therapist felt she was doing really great. And she was just kind of telling him the things he wanted to hear, or she, I don't know. And after 5-6 sessions, the therapist really kind of said, well, look, you're doing really well, and you know, we are done. And she told me she went into her car in the parking lot and cried, you know, just being sad about not being able to come out of this. And so
The therapist was like, I feel better, bye.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's like, oh, you're doing great. And he didn't see the underlying patterns. And so that pattern of submissiveness, of not expressing herself, allowing that. And that came out in therapy. It came out, for example, she then wanted to take medication for her depression. And she was quite anxious that I was against medication. And so And I said, well, the truth is, I don't think they can help, but they're not the guarantee. But I think it's more important that you do what you think is important. And so she said, okay, I'll do. So she took that as a permission to just explore that. So she took some medication. Then later on, she realized, she felt they weren't as useful as she had hoped she'd be. And then she put them off. But again, she could do that. And then she felt, oh, I might be critical of her. Like, you know, you have to stick with it once you start something. And you can see how that parental interaction comes in, a very negative experience of a mother, right? I can't explore and try out things. And so that's what we really did in therapy. We allowed her to try out things. And she ultimately, about after a year or so, she came really to this point that she said, I'm able to express myself in my close relationships. I'm able to really voice what I'm feeling and engage in the world. And she said, it's completely, it's an unbeknownst feeling to me, an unexplored terrain psychologically. And she's so content. She said, I for the first time, I feel like an adult in my own life.
That's great.
At 45, yes, it was amazing, you know. So these are the type of situations where somebody comes into a vitality, and that's just fun to behold and to be a part of.
So what kind of methods do you use, like CBT? Do you use, you know, dialectical behavioral therapy or ACT, you know, acceptance commitment therapy, or do you don't really give names to it? You just talk to people?
Well, I think all of those I use, and I think Carl Jung said it quite wrong. Right. He said, you want to learn all the techniques, but when you encounter another soul, you best treat them as a human. And I think so. Yes, I've got trained in the CBT. That was my original clinical training with CBT. And much of at that time was kind of all of the third wave, what we now call third wave cognitive behavioral therapy. So acceptance and commitment therapy and mindfulness approaches and schema therapy was quite popular back then as well. So I learned all of those, but I've gradually kind of expanded into psychodynamic conceptualizations that tap a little bit more in the deeper structures, some of the unconscious processes, the things clients can't reflect upon. And so there's happened a lot with the relational turn in psychoanalysis that is very big at the moment. And that informs my practice at the moment a lot to that interpersonal context that we really are social beings, and that drives much of what we do and why we suffer.
So have you worked with people that have, again, narcissism or multiple personality disorder? Have you worked on cases where, you know, many therapists may be like, wow, this is too much for me, this is really heavy stuff?
Yeah. So I work a lot within the intersection of trauma and personality, and that is definitely an area that I find quite fascinating. And it's often an area where some clinicians kind of shy away from, because it's quite intense work. It's quite, you know, very strong emotions emerge, strong feelings can come up in these type of situations. And I enjoy that. I enjoy working with these type of situations and feelings when it becomes very strong and intense and you realize something is going on there. And so, yes, I work. So I enjoy working with personality disorder from that sense. And another reason I enjoy working with clients from personality disorder is that their struggle is often a very fundamental struggle about how to be in this world. How can I be a human being in a fundamental way? And so it goes very much to the core of our beliefs about ourselves, about the world. And the changes that can be achieved on that level are very fundamental and significant for the client. And that's a very enjoyable task, really, to embark on with the client.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on support us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click support us today. Now back to the show.
What does it mean to have a personality disorder? what happens? You know, when someone has trauma, what does it mean when their personality becomes disordered?
Yeah, it's a good question. Some people might say the diagnosis of personality disorder is a little bit of an offense, or in, you know, kind of like we are saying, oh, you're a bad person, your whole personality is disrupted. And that's how it often feels too, if it is mishandled by the clinician too. Sometimes we clinicians use that, because what happens is personality disorder has two elements. The one element is a dysregulation of self. So how I relate within myself is dysregulated in a certain way. So that can mean the way I observe myself. So self-awareness processes, the self-regulation of emotions. So I struggle to regulate these internal processes. But other aspects of self-regulation are, for example, having realistic goals, having good self-focus in not getting distracted by other stimuli, so and maintaining task-oriented. So those things are self-disturbance, what we call. So they are aspects of my internal self. And then we say other disturbance or interpersonal disruption means how I relate to others, right? And that's the aspect that we most often see. And that's where that negative stigma of personality comes by, that we say, well, they're really difficult people to be around. But what it really means is, a better way to understand it is that I have had to find ways to be in the world and with others. So survival strategies, coping strategies, defense mechanisms, however you want to call it. But I find a way of being in my original traumatic world. And now I hold on to that in a rigid way, because I still think that's the best way to relate to the world. And that brings me into conflict with people that are non-traumatic in a way, that aren't my original environment, that are interested to hear what I'm feeling. And so then I get into trouble with them because I don't know how to handle that. I get mistrustful. I act in what looks like manipulative ways.
So, you don't intend this, but how, for a normal person, or I guess, I don't know, whatever word I'll use, for a person that doesn't have a personality disorder, how would they react to certain things you do? And those same things, maybe they would normally be innocuous, but someone with a personality disorder may act in an outsized way. So like, what are some of those things?
Exactly. So, and what that really means is, if I translate that a little bit differently, we'd be saying your reaction is a response to a traumatic interpersonal event. And that makes you react in disproportionate ways. And that, and it looks so unbelievable to the outsider. I'll give you an example from a client I had, for example. She was a nurse and she had a partner who was also a nurse. They were both on shift work. And she recalled, you know, one day she came home from work and she had a late shift. He had a morning shift. Her partner is on the couch, just kind of relaxing, sleeping. And she really gets angry at him. It's like, really kind of like, what are you doing? And then ask this, you know, kind of intense reaction, and just kind of like, you know, look at the house, you should have cleaned up, why didn't you do that, why did you do that, and really has this intense reaction, and it kind of gets, it's quite obvious from the, you know, situation that, you know, she knows in some part when she reflects in therapy, she's like, I know, I, you know, he was working too, he had an early shift, why do I get so angry, right? And so we explore that, and long story short, she uncovers a memory of her when she was 4 or 5 years old. She walks out at night and sees her drunken father on the couch, all in his vomit, and she has to clean that up. And that was a repeated scene that she had as a child, that her drunken father on the couch. And so now she sees her sleeping partner on the couch, and it triggers that memory, right? But it's unconscious in a certain way. We are not always reflected in that way. And so that original pain, we're trying to shield from, and so we only see the here and now pain. And that's where things get often out of hand, because the partner also says, well, why aren't you, you're crazy, you're a psycho bitch, right? Those things, why can't you let me be? Rather than going, man, that's a really funny reaction, what's behind it, so to speak, right? And that's what therapy really is trying to do. So we are trying to say there is something behind that.
If you know, if you're in a relationship and stuff, and you know your partner acts like that to you, your defense mechanism, of course, is going to kick in. You're not going to be like a psychologist and say, "Fascinating, You know, where does that react? Well, what do you think is the underlying, you know, part of your mind that, so, you know, then as soon as you react to that, like if someone was yelling at me, I'm laying on the couch and said, just got off work, leave me alone, what the, you know, and then, so now it becomes like a defensive thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would think, you know, in therapy, sure, you can explore that, but how do you explore it in the dynamics of a relationship? What do you do? Do you give your partner a code word? And when you say the code word, they know, like, hey, maybe I'm acting in the, you know, an outsized way. Like, what do you do?
Yeah, that's a good question. Of course, you're absolutely right. It's much more complicated in the relationship, right? How do I live with somebody who brings these type of traumas? So the one thing I often say is, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. If 9 out of 10 times your partner was okay about you relaxing, and you know, like, so if you relax and doing other things, so then you realize, hold on, this is out of proportion. This is untypical, even for them. So there must be something more at hand here. But you don't have to. The difficult balance is you don't want to avoid the subject. That's what often also happens is, right, we kind of sweep it under the carpet. It's like, oh, you're a lovely person, whatever. That's a fluke of your personality. What happens is then we don't address the issue. We don't resolve the underlying issue, even in the relationship, if we avoid the conflict. The conflict in the sense, hey, that wasn't right. What's happening? I know. But it needs to happen in that balanced way, right, where I'm not thinking you're a psychopath, but I need to be I kind of need to hold you in a space where I think you're better than what is happening, because else we are back in the trauma, right? I'm else back, maybe the drunken shit ass father who just reacts impulsively to you rather than trying to create something new. And that's the difficulty. Yeah. And that's not easy.
I think also too, the person that's doing the yelling, there's a big component of embarrassment. So asking them, you know, hey, what's going on? What? Why are you so angry? Like, you know, if you're trying to be nice and all that, the person's embarrassment, I guess, may kick in, and they're just like, nah, I don't want to talk about it. They're, you know, I'm just guessing. But how do you, I hate to say safe space, but how do you let your partner know, first of all, that I didn't appreciate that, and that was really, like, mean? And second of all, like, you know, please don't be embarrassed, but tell me, what do you think happened? Why did you say that to me? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, so I think, as you rightly say, you eventually want to address it. Sometimes we say, don't address it, don't strike when the feeling is hot. So you might want to say in that moment, right, say, hey, look, let's take a break. Let's, you know, I need, or I'm, and you take a break and you let them calm down. You let you calm down. You basically get back to that point where you're like, are you okay? You know, can we talk about this, right? So you want to strike it when it's not hot. You want to relay. And then I often say, make it personal. Personal in the way is, look, you know, I felt attacked. I felt unjustified. You know, in the reaction was, you know, quite scary for me. And I was wondering what's going on there. So, right, you bring in yourself, but you create an atmosphere where we can talk about it, where we can reflect about it, or where we can go to a place where we haven't yet been. Because trauma ultimately collapses thinking, collapses imagination, collapses reflecting. And so that implodes. And so the idea is, if we can restore it in us as a couple, in therapy, in any other way, then we have a chance to go beyond that where we've been stuck so far, right? That's the chance.
What if, like, this exact couple, what if, you know, the woman gave you permission to contact her partner when stuff like this happens, and to just, like, not get his side of the story, but understand and how it came across to him, and then you calmly speak to her about it? You know, do you think that's a good idea, bad idea to do that kind of thing?
Well, of course, in that situation, it can be helpful, you know, to create, basically what you want to do is, right, you want to create therapeutic opportunities, not just 50 minutes a week in therapy, but you want to have them high dose, so to speak. If you, the more we can create them, the better, right? So of course, if I can enlist the partner in a sense of curiosity about this, awesome. If I can get the client also to start being curious about themselves, I know that, because, right, most of the times clients also know that isn't ideal. But what happens is we shame ourselves, right? We get, you know, oh, I'm no good. Look at me. I'm losing my temper again. I'm this, you know. And so often what happens is their own dysregulation, because they have no internal good parental models that help them regulate that, right? Because no, you're not crazy. You're anxious. You're overwhelmed. You know, your drunken father is there puking all over the floor. Of course, you're all over. You're angry about that too. Your father should not be doing all of that. He should be the one that is coherent, organized, right? So often it is restoring the traumatic context. The overreaction happens there in that fits the traumatic context. We say personality is trauma decontextualized. So when we lose the trauma out of sight, it looks like personality.
Yeah. How do you not, what is a typical pattern with someone that has like this very high level of trauma? You know, they may, like I said, have a, you know, yell at their partner, or the partner may come back in a good way or a bad way. What if the person then goes into like a self-pity mode? You know, like essentially you can't get them to acknowledge what happened. They'll go from like anger and self-defense to self-pity to something else and back and forth again. And there's just no way in. Like, what do you do?
Some of these situations can be very difficult. And once the relationship is inflamed in that way, as you describe it, right? And that can easily happen, that this relationship is inflamed and becomes highly charged in that way. And then sometimes it really is important to take a break. Maybe sometimes as a couple, sometimes to get couple therapy involved. Again, how can we restore thinking, any sense of positivity that doesn't throw out the baby with the bathwater? And sometimes it's when a client has a lot of these type of traumatic experiences, I sometimes say it's a little bit like a sunburn. You've been exposed to too much sun in your childhood, and now you carry the sunburn around. And so if somebody touches you, it hurts as hell. So, right, you go, fuck, why are you hitting me? And you're like, I wasn't hitting you. I was just tapping you on the shoulder. Now, why are you fucking so defensive? I clearly can feel the pain, right? And you can see how that charge back and forth goes back, you know, doesn't help the situation too. So you want to, in some way, and that is important, you eventually have to cool down. And you're right, if the other person can't see that there's a sunburn on them, then there's very little leverage you have as a partner, as a therapist either, right? If they are not coming and they're not yet able to see that, it's very difficult.
Well, as a therapist, I know everyone's different, but how long does it take you to get through to somebody? Like, how much trust is needed between you and the person? How much, I don't know, rapport is needed before you can make headway with them?
Yeah. It depends on the client's prior experience. I often say there are two major dimensions in how we relate, right? Therapy is trying to correct something, right? To help to correct and give advice, if you very simply said it. But that has to be balanced with a sense of feeling connected, like you said, trust, right? And if I had very little trust and good experiences where people were loving, supportive, just genuinely happy with me, if that tank is quite empty, then trying to give direction isn't going to work, because what they first need is they need to feel connection. They need to feel loved. They need that first. And so sometimes in therapy, it means a lot of that. I had once a client for 3 months, we wouldn't say a word in therapy. You'd come every week and he would not say a word. But a lot was happening.
Did he want to come to therapy?
Yeah, he wanted very much. I often say, think about it. If somebody comes once a week, you know, we are too busy to waste our time, right? Everybody's too busy. So he came once a week, punctual. And much was happening. You know, there were lots of I often felt that, you know, one time there was a lot what we call transference, where we encounter transference. So I often had much of experience, like I wanted to have him lay down on the couch, put a blanket over him. These were fantasies I was having. One time, you know, he was covering with both of his hands his face, and I was quite concerned. And, you know, I was thinking, is he okay? I could sense something wasn't right. Is he still breathing? And then it reminded of me like a mother with an infant, right? That always worries, are you still breathing? Are you okay? You know, we check in with the infant. We go through that stage 3 months. I wouldn't say a word. And before that, we had about therapy we had 10 months prior therapy where we did talk, but didn't do any headway. Then we had that period of 3 months not talking, basically, but lots emotional stuff happening, right? So we store up the sense of connection, right? Much of what I felt was like a mother that was fussing over an infant.
Did you say to him, like, you do know this is talk therapy, right?
I didn't, no, because I felt if he is an infant, if he's really in that stage, kind of like a mother that is breastfeeding her child, you don't say to the child, look, I know I'm breastfeeding you, little one. I hope you're really thankful for this. I hope you're getting all you need from my breast. You don't do that. The initial phase of that is magic in a way. My mother magically, Winnicott describes it as there's a certain magic. The initial period of life is my parents magically provide, ideally, if things go right. Right? We don't think of it. The baby doesn't think about what that really means for the mother. And ideally, the mother doesn't intrude upon it. She just gives the child that. Then when they're older, yes, you discuss it and you talk about it. Not with an infant. And we were in that stage where it was clear, no, this is, you just soak it up and we don't need to talk about it now. We'll talk about it some other time. We just let it sit. And that was really significant change for him. And after this, so he had been living with his parents, kind of soaking it up there. And after that, he was able to move out, you know, and he was a young man, failure to launch. And he had the sense of, you know, you often would say to me prior, I'm retired from life. I'm done. The state should pay me a pension, that type of very aggressive too at times. And after that, he became a lot softer. So that's this, right, this filling up of the needing to feel loved, trusted. And once that sits, then we can give direction again, that it falls on more a fuller cup, so to speak.
How did you make the breakthrough with him to get him to talk in the first place?
Well, eventually, after a while, he came in and he said, look, I really kind of try. I think I want to talk today. I said, okay, we'll talk.
Well, okay. So it just came from him.
It came from him, yeah. So he took it. He took what he needed to take in a certain way. And it was obvious that something was happening. Because again, you don't come, you know, all of our lives are too busy to waste our time 1 hour sitting somewhere, right? Then we can do better stuff with it. Even if it is watching YouTube.
What about, you know, mentioning your bio about narcissism, that you work with clients that have that. Yeah. I haven't asked much about it, but what is that and how does it manifest?
Yeah, it's a good question. Narcissism is by nature a dysregulation of our self-worth. So the inability to maintain a stable sense of self-worth in a nutshell. That's what narcissistic presentations often come like. I got interested in it because it's the stepchild of psychotherapy. Because everybody now talks about, you know, we do DBT, we have DBT for borderline. Everybody talks about borderliner. But there's very little that we do and that we've done for clients that suffer from narcissistic injury in a way, and narcissistic pain. So that's how I got interested in it. It's like, we are not doing much for these type of clients.
Are they particularly difficult to deal with? And if so, why?
Yeah, they're, well, obviously there's a difficulty in that they bring this very dynamic of this entitlement, right? So there's a sense of entitlement that they bring in themselves. Right. And they often have that for themselves, too. I have to be the best. I have to be the biggest, strongest, fastest. Right. And they bring that to therapy, too. You know, my therapist has to be the best, the, you know, the greatest, the expert. Right. I remember this man who came in and after 5 sessions, he said, he comes in. I don't think we have done any therapy so far. I don't think you've done anything here. That's how he starts. Right. It's all my fault. But they bring that demanding, entitled attitude to the therapeutic relationship. And if you're not very grounded in yourself, right, you quickly lose yourself. You get very anxious. Oh, fuck, I'm letting this client down. I'm not good enough. So it triggers your own narcissistic struggle. So you lose your balance of self-worth quickly too. Oh, yeah, I'm a shitty therapist. So it's important that you can ground yourself and then you might say something, I wonder how that is for you to come here and sit with a therapist who you think is no good.
Okay. And what were they saying? That's such, like, what have you heard?
And then he's like, oh, well, you know, and then they suddenly, first of all.
It would be funny if you said, why do you think you chose such a bad therapist then? Yeah. How does that reflect on you?
Yeah, so that would be if I give it completely back to them, right? But so now they have to reflect. And now Kernberg and transference-focused therapists, they call this a therapist-centered interpretation, where I'm you know, how is that for you to be with such a therapist and to be in such a therapy? And then they have to reflect, right? Now I have to reflect. I'm not becoming defensive as a therapist. I reflect with them. Basically, I sit next to them and I ask them, so how is that? And rather than defending myself, and then again, we can reflect about what's happening. And then I might be later on saying, I'm wondering whether that same voice that you bring here also ails you at times. And then all the time. I'm all the time under stress. I'm all the time aware about how I'm not doing enough and how I'm not good enough. And what they're doing is they are hoping that they can solve it outside when, of course, the conflict is inside. And once you can bring it back inside, then we have a chance to really deal with it.
Okay. What would you say is like the most difficult personality type to work with and why?
That's a good question. I would be saying those clients that have shut themselves off to their suffering the most. Those are the ones that are the hardest to deal with. Narcissism falls under that at times because we are not allowed to suffer. We are not allowed. That feels all too vulnerable, too weak. There are other forms, sometimes avoidant or schizoid clients that don't want anything, that have cut off themselves from suffering. Once we cut off ourselves from suffering, there's very little leverage. No pain, no gain, we say, right? And the same is true in therapy. If you're not able to feel suffering and pain, then there's very little impetus to change, psychologically speaking and motivational. Why change that?
What does that look like when you cut yourself off from suffering? What does that mean?
So it means in a way, so right, in a personality disordered client, for example, a narcissistic client, the typical thing is it's the bad stuff is all out there. Everybody is an asshole. Everybody is bad. Everybody's treating me bad. That type of sense that I'm not bad, but bad is out there. So that's a way to defend against suffering.
With the most difficult type people, when you're talking about narcissism and all that.
When we shut off from suffering, right? And that's ultimately, Neville Symington says, that has described that choice to turn towards pain or turn away from pain. That is in its fundamental narcissistic struggle. Act calls it emotional avoidance, but it's this, I'm turning away from pain. I don't feel like the sense of entitlement. I shouldn't be having it. I get angry. I get, you know, the sense of one-upmanship. This shouldn't have happened to me. How dare? And while there is a valid point at times to the original traumatic context, eventually we abandon a part of this painful experience. And we know that suffering, the ability to mourn, narcissists don't mourn. They're trying to compensate for the loss, but they're not trying to come to terms with it. And the same happens if we cut off to pain, right? We cut off to this vulnerability of life. We cut off to the difficulties of life. And we know the people, right? The people who have been able to go through that, those are the people we want to hang out with because they are compassionate. They understand the complexities of life. They are the people, you know, that we want to be friends with because they get it, because they're still trying to somehow get it all in. And that's where things really go astray and where it becomes very difficult. And sometimes they have to really, right, something dramatic has to happen, a significant midlife crisis, some other crisis, right? The partner finally has to leave them, something drastic that really confronts them suddenly with the cost of what they've been avoiding much of their life. And then they come to therapy. Most of the time, you know, that's when they come.
Okay. Well, very good. Tobias, where can people, for you personally, if they want to see you or get to your clinic, what areas do you serve?
I'm now in New Zealand in Napier. We do online therapy as well. So we are here in Napier. But there are many, many good clinicians out there. I often say, find a good therapist to reflect with you on your life that helps you to turn towards, you know, the things you don't want to feel, the suffering, the pain, and take your time. It takes time.
Understood. Well, very good. For people listening, that, you know, what kind of therapist should they look for? Could they look for it? You know, how do they know how to navigate who to find, you know, CBT or ACT? Or, you know, what do you recommend for someone that doesn't know how to take that first step, but they want help?
Yeah, I would be saying, they often say, right, it's the model is not so foregrounded anymore. And the research doesn't uphold that anyway, what type of model you are. But I think you need to find a person with whom you can relate and who can relate to you. And trust your gut first 3, 4, 5 sessions, right? Get the, where you feel, am I feeling hurt? Does this person relate to me on a whole person level in a way, rather than a very technical, you know, kind of hiding behind their notepad, scribbling things down all the time and or whatever things we do as therapists too that avoid us from engaging fully with you, to meet you, you know, fully. And that's where really transformative work can happen. And when somebody really is with us in the room, and that's what we find again and again, the research on what's the main ingredient of successful therapy is the relationship.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, Tobias, it was good to meet you and talk with you and learn from you. And thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.